Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about moving from warheads to windmills with Timon Wallace, who is coordinator of the coalition Warheads to Windmills. You can find the website at warheads2windmills.org. And we are going to talk about the new book as well as about the coalition. Timon Wallace, welcome back to Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much, David. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for what you're doing. I understand you've got a book just coming out.
I do. I think we might have discussed the previous one of the previous versions of it a few years ago. We had a report which was a fairly thin volume, you know, looking at how to pay for a Green New Deal by getting rid of nuclear weapons and using all that money for the Green New Deal. And I wanted to update it because it was from 2019 or so, and it got longer and longer and more intense. And so now it's a full paperback with almost 1,000 footnotes and a lot of details.
What happened to the Green New Deal? Did it inspire actions around the world and on the local level and get wonderful, amazing, unappreciated things into Joe Biden's massive piece of legislation, despite 95% of it being cut out? Or is it a nice idea that remains to be acted on that the Congress has refused to budge for?
Well, I certainly would vote for the latter. In on the whole, I mean, it's still a live idea, and it has support in Congress from the Progressive Caucus, and but it's not being enacted. And you know, one of the things I looked at in the new book is the Inflation Reduction Act, and its companion, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, and you know what benefits those will potentially bring, and as opposed to the downsides of both of those. And on the whole, you know, my conclusion with the Inflation Reduction Act is that, as I'm sure other people have also reached this conclusion, that, you know, the overall impact could well be negative overall because of all the loopholes in there, the requirements to drill for oil before you can have windmills offshore, and the stumbling blocks in the way of getting the tax credits that they had before, which are now clouded with all these requirements that they can't, you know, be sourced from China and so on. And really the overall impact, which we've felt, I was just saying, you know, we've had solar panels put on our roof in the last few weeks, and the cost of solar panels and EVs are going to go up rather than down because of the Inflation Reduction Act. So it's actually causing inflation, at least on the climate mitigation front, because of all these restrictions. You know, we don't want to trade with China. You know, it's all part of the war with China, really. And as you probably know, you know, 80% of our EV batteries come from China. 85% of the solar panels in the world are made in China. So if you're trying to increase and build capacity and actually get solar panels, you know, in place, and you're trying to prevent people from buying them from the main source, you're going to run into difficulties.
Can we just go back to us for a second to, you can't put windmills anywhere you haven't drilled for oil? This strikes me as comically, absurdly counterproductive. How did this make it through the brilliance of the congressional sausage making?
The brilliance, yeah. Well, you know, as you know, there's Joe Manchin in that sausage machine, and you know, a lot of things got into that bill which are counterproductive and as you say, comical. I mean, the, you know, not just the requirements from states to open up access to offshore drilling in order to get the funding for offshore wind turbines, but you know, there's all this money for nuclear power plants, for carbon capture technologies, all the things that we have in our book as false solutions, and you know, things that are well proven by now to be not the way forward.
I want to come back to several other points you've made and the book in general, but it's amazing to me how many people just relentlessly point me toward the famous nuclear scientist Oliver Stone on the wisdom of going to nuclear energy when they don't seem to have a coherent argument to put forward. What is happening there?
Well, our book, you know, looks at all these difficulties and challenges, but it's also about the solutions. And the number one block that we have are the companies, you know, the nuclear weapons companies, the fossil fuel companies, but also, you know, there's such a huge vested interest in the nuclear power industry from companies that want to make a quick buck, you know, making nuclear power plants. And it's high technology. It's got lots of funding from the US government. It's the kind of solution that, you know, your rocket scientists like Oliver Stone are pushing. But, you know, it's nonsense. It's utter nonsense, not only from a climate point of view, but also, as we've seen in Ukraine, you know, these are ticking time bombs in potential war zones that they want to put all over the world. And they're the source of plutonium for making nuclear weapons. So the whole thing is just crazy, utterly crazy.
It seems like one issue that ought to be separable from the madness of war, and yet we know that the desire for nuclear weapons drives the desire for nuclear energy. And you describe U.S. infrastructure and energy policy as part of a war with China. What in the heck kind of sense does that make?
Yeah, well, as if war with Russia is not enough, you know, we've got to have war with China. I don't know. I looked a lot in the book at these dynamics with Russia and China and the US, and you know, the sort of obvious point of that, you know, the countries that have the largest carbon emissions in the world that have to work together in order to resolve the climate crisis are all pointing nuclear weapons at each other, you know. And the Ukraine war has highlighted how these issues are linked, because it's put a complete stop to the climate agenda. Having a war with Russia in Europe and the sabotage of the pipeline and the huge subsidies going into fossil fuel to compensate for Russian gas, you know, all these things are, I think people are waking up to that, and I hope that that will make a difference.
Let's hope so. Tell people where they can get the book.
Well, the book is available at your local bookshop and from bookshop.org, which gives a portion of their profits to local bookshops. If you really have to, you can go to those evil sites like Amazon, but there are plenty of other places to buy books, and it's available anywhere you can get books.
And it's called Warheads to Windmills.
Exactly. Warheads to Windmills, Preventing Climate Catastrophe and Nuclear War.
And we are speaking with Tim and Wallace, who is coordinator of the coalition Warheads to Windmills, which has the website warheadstowindmills.org. What is the coalition up to, working on?
Well, we're just getting going, actually. Part of the rationale for producing this book is to back up our piece of legislation that's in Congress at the moment, called the Norton Bill, HR 2775, which is the Warheads to Windmills bill. Basically, it says, you know, the U.S. should sign the Nuclear Ban Treaty, eliminate its nuclear weapons with all the other countries, and put all those wasted resources into the climate crisis and other pressing human needs. And we, you know, that's our gold standard that we're trying to promote. But we've also, as I mentioned, got no illusions that, you know, this Congress especially, but, you know, any U.S. government is going to change their nuclear weapons policy anytime soon without a lot more pressure coming from civil society organizations and movements, and putting pressure, especially on the companies. And so that's our focus, really, is building a stronger divestment and boycott movement in this country, to combine with what's going on internationally, because there's a lot going on globally, not only with the nuclear ban treaty, but now with the beginnings of a fossil fuel treaty that would eventually ban burning of fossil fuels. And countries are coming on board with these treaties, and they're putting pressure on these companies, because these companies are all global, you know, multinational companies. And so, you know, working in tandem with countries like Ireland, for instance, which make having anything to do with nuclear weapons an offense punishable up to life in prison in Ireland, you know, we're trying to encourage more countries to follow that example. And we're trying to, you know, use that pressure that they're putting on companies to double up the pressure in this country. So our coalition is trying to build support for that from both climate and nuclear weapons organizations, including, of course, World Beyond War, who's a great partner in our coalition, and Code Pink and Veterans for Peace and many other groups that are very active around the country. You know, we're trying to find ways to work together to build this pressure.
Are there co-sponsors on that legislation?
Yes, a small number. There's 12 at the moment on the Norton bill, and there's 42 altogether on the Back from the Brink resolution, which calls on the U.S. to embrace the goals and provisions of the treaty, of the nuclear ban treaty. And there's other pieces of legislation, as I mentioned, the Green New Deal, but there's also the fossil fuel, I forget the title of it actually, but there's a fossil fuel divestment bill, which has a very small number of co-sponsors. I mean, these bills are token. You know, they're not going to get passed, as I said, but they're a way of identifying who are our allies in Congress and how can we push them a bit further. We use in the book the sort of social barometer tool to sort of identify, you know, who are our allies, who are our opponents, and, you know, who's in between and to what extent, and how we can help push them a little bit towards our direction.
What is you're talking about a federal U.S. congressional bill on fossil fuel divestment? I have a hard time wrapping my head around what that would mean when the U.S. military is the number one consumer of fossil fuels. What would be divested?
Well, I mean, I think it's, as I said, these bills aren't going to get passed.
I understand.
But there's, as you know, there's a huge growing fossil fuel divestment movement, which has now pulled more than $40 trillion in assets out of the reach of the fossil fuel companies. And that includes, you know, lots of cities have now done that, as well as, you know, faith communities and so on. But Maine and New York, I think, are the two states that have successfully passed legislation divesting from fossil fuels. And so the congressional national bill is modeled on those. And it's, you know, it's basically calling for public funds to be divested from those companies. The fossil fuel, I don't remember the title of it. It's only got a few co-sponsors, so I'd have to look that up, exactly what it says. But I mean, you know, it includes things like, you know, no more fossil fuel subsidies. As you know, that's a big, another, you know, ironic thing from the Inflation Reduction Act, is that it's pouring more money into fossil fuel industry and infrastructure for building gas pipelines and so on, when we're trying to stop all that.
Well, that is clear and huge. That would be wonderful for the U.S. government to stop giving subsidies to fossil fuels. Exactly. I suppose that is a form of investment. We've found in some locations, such as here in Charlottesville, Virginia, you can get the local government to divest from weapons if you combine it with divesting from fossil fuels. You're divesting from the good, sacred, wonderful, humanitarian, you know, deadly weapons. Because you're tying it to, and it's an educational process, because you make the connections between the two, the evil fossil fuels that children don't like, you know. And I don't know if you've, I'm sure that it's also the case that divesting only from nuclear weapons is a little bit easier than divesting from all weapons. But what seems to work in your experience?
Yeah, well, there is this growing, small but burgeoning movement called fossil and fissile divestment, which is trying to combine these two things. You know, this is internationally.
Right.
And, you know, we're very excited by examples that you just mentioned where, you know, you've got your city to divest from both weapons and fossil fuels. There's a few other examples around the country that have done similar things. And, you know, that's what we're trying to encourage. And we did have, as you say, because there's a much bigger movement for fossil fuel divestment, you know, it's easier to tag that along. And we've gone to student groups, for instance, on campuses and said, you know, that are working on fossil fuel divestments and say, you know, how about adding on, you know, nuclear weapons to that? And we've had some interest in that. So, you know, it's something we want to work on and see how far we can get with it.
So taking a step above the U.S. government, at least theoretically, to the United Nations, in recent weeks, there have been gatherings, meetings about fossil fuel and other environmental destruction and about nuclear weapons. How do you think those
meetings? So we were there was a group of us in New York at the nuclear ban treaty meeting, which, you know, like the fossil fuel, you know, COP28 was meeting in Dubai under the presidency of, you know, an oil magnate. And similarly, you know, the nuclear weapons meeting was in New York, you know, in the home of the belly of the beast. But nevertheless, you know, there were activists in both of these meetings. And one of the things we organized as the Warheads to Windmills Coalition was an online, you know, live link up between activists in Dubai that were meeting at the COP28 and activists in New York that were meeting about the nuclear ban treaty. And we had a great, I don't know if you were present, but we had a number of organizations that had people in both places, like the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and the International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War and some other groups, as well as people that were working on the fossil fuel treaty in Dubai and those working on, you know, ICANN. We had the new executive director of ICANN, Melissa Park. And so we had this, you know, exchange of perspectives and, you know, sharing of learnings and so on from the two meetings. And that was quite exciting. And as I said, you know, we're trying to encourage countries that have signed the nuclear ban treaty, for instance, to take stronger measures to put pressure on the companies like Ireland has. And so that was a big part of our goal in New York was to, you know, we delivered a paper to the meeting and spoke to it and tried to lobby the countries there about, you know, strengthening their national implementation of the treaty. So we were working on that. The fossil fuel treaty people, you know, they went into the COP28 with two countries supporting the fossil fuel treaty idea, both of them tiny islands in the Pacific, who will disappear completely with climate change. But they came out of the meeting at the end of the 2 weeks with 12 countries in support, including some bigger ones like Colombia. So they were quite excited about that progress. It's still a long way to go. But, you know, if we can combine these you know, global efforts for really putting into law, you know, these what has to happen to save, you know, humanity from these two existential threats, then we can work, you know, down the scale to build support for those.
Are we reaching a point at which there are corporations that see more advantage in steering clear of nuclear weapons and more disadvantage in facing criminal penalties in places like Ireland if they stay involved in nuclear weapons because they work multinationally, and they have to work in the countries that have sane nuclear weapons policies?
Well, we're hoping that that's happening. It's hard to really pin that down. But you know, we've had two nuclear weapons companies in Europe that have pulled out of the nuclear weapons business in the last couple of years, and we don't know for sure the reasons. But Serco, which is a British company that was involved in the atomic weapons establishment in England, pulled out, and they did say in their sort of annual report or whatever, I mean, it's in writing, that they've decided that it's not in their interest to be involved in the nuclear weapons business. So that's exciting.
Yeah.
We had an earlier example with Honeywell, which was not what we intended, but we started a campaign about 5 years ago to get people to refuse to buy their thermostats from Honeywell and to write to the company. And we had thousands of people doing that across the country. And you know, our local Quaker meeting here in Massachusetts, for instance, had this lively email exchange with one of the vice presidents of Honeywell, who originally wrote and said, well, we don't make nuclear weapons. And they wrote back and said, well, actually you do. And you know, this went on. And the interesting thing about it is that Honeywell then sold their thermostat division. We wanted them to sell their nuclear weapons division, but instead they decided to hold on to the nuclear weapons and get rid of their thermostats so that they couldn't be subject to this kind of humiliation or whatever. Yeah. So it's not a straight line, but you know, the more we can get countries and cities and so on to be putting this pressure on the companies, they don't like it. We know that for sure. And we've had lots of examples, you know, going back through history of boycotts and divestment campaigns, you know, having a real impact on these companies. So
for sure,
we're hoping that it will yield some results.
Because it seems like maybe the country signing and ratifying the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons has reached a bit of a plateau. It's harder to get new ones. So that's obviously has to remain one strategy, but getting the ones that have ratified to take right. steps to make it even, to put pressure on the corporations, may be an easier push. I don't know.
Well, it's not one or the other. I mean, we're still, you know, we got two huge countries just about to come on board in the next year, Brazil and Indonesia, which will be pretty big. You know, they're important countries globally, and they have a lot of U.S. companies also.
Yes.
So, you know, that kind of thing is what we're looking for. And of course, you know, in Europe, you know, it's the pressure is building hugely in Europe for a change within the NATO countries. And, you know, the first country that breaks ranks and signs the treaty will open a floodgate, I think. Germany has a coalition government that's supposedly committed to signing the treaty. So does Spain. Iceland, the prime minister of Iceland and almost her entire parliament supports signing the treaty. As does Finland. Finland and Sweden just joined the NATO, as you know, but they're still very strongly anti-nuclear. And so, you know, there's pressure in Belgium and the Netherlands, and even in Italy. So at some point that's going to crack, and that's going to be a big shift, because, you know, the U.S., part of their whole excuse for having to have nuclear weapons is, well, our NATO allies, you know, need us to have these weapons, and you know, it's for them, which is obviously rubbish.
Yes, quite obviously. we got not too many minutes left, Tim and okay. Wallace. This also seems like a moment of a lot of activism about particular wars that right. risk developing into nuclear war. How do you work with all of the energy and excitement that people have in opposing one, or in some cases two or three particular wars, and making the need for an overall shift to sustainable, peaceful policies part of the demand?
Well, that's a great question. as the Ukraine war, which I spent a lot of time discussing in the book, has not been easy on on peace movements in general, because there's just been this outburst of support for Ukraine and outrage at Russia and so on, and it's skewed a lot of thinking. And I think, in a way, the Gaza bombardment going on now is helping to redress that balance a bit, because people are, as you say, there's a lot of activism on the campuses and so on, and people are on the streets, and I think that helps people to realize, war is pretty stupid, and as well as being, hugely destructive and evil. And I hope that that will carry over a bit to Ukraine and to the bigger thinking about, like, do we really want to have a war with China? I mean, there's just some crazy, crazy, things going on out there, and people are rising up at the moment, and let's hope that that will lead on to bigger questioning of the whole system.
And yet it seems that the Ukraine war is the war that many experts think have pushed us closer than ever before to nuclear war and nuclear apocalypse for most life on the planet. And you would think that if we could succeed in educating people about what that means, then it wouldn't matter how much they were falling for the war propaganda on one side of a war and cheering for one side of a war. It would matter more than that to avoid exterminating life on Earth.
Well, that's our task. We've got to educate people about that. And as you mentioned, the propaganda is out there and it's pretty strong. And it's hard to believe sometimes what people will fall for in this age of Trump and everything else, But we're up against some really big challenges for sure. And of course, as you mentioned, the nuclear danger in Ukraine is still there for sure, but so is with Israel, and the only country in that region with nuclear weapons. And if things don't go their way, who knows? It's we have a lot to work on.
Well, thank you for everything you've been working on thus far, and I'm glad you're going to keep doing it. The book is called Warheads to Windmills, and the website is warheadstowindmills.org. We've been speaking with Timon Wallace. Timon, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.